guess if you want to talk with me in private, then you're welcome about this.
If you didn't advertise your other podcast, so
Yeah. Right, so what I'll talk about here today is I will go, I'll try to go rather quickly to the first part of the talk where I will argue that anti-symmetric tensor field could be dark matter candidate. And I will give you pros and contrasts for that. And second part of the talk will be what are the prospects of constructing a dynamical theory which contains such a field, dynamical gravitational theory. And unfortunately, I don't have very good news at the moment. Perhaps I do, but not perfect. So there are some references here, and of course here in the audience, John is certainly the expert on the field. Just a few words about it. One way of thinking about this anti-symmetric tensor field is if you add to standard Einstein metric tensor an anti-symmetric part, so it is just anti-symmetrized part of the metric tensor. And it has 6 degrees of freedom, while this one has 10, so 10 plus 6 is 16, which is exactly what you would expect from a 4 by 4 matrix. The history is very long, so that goes all the way back to 1925 when Einstein proposed this unified theory of gravity and electromagnetism. That doesn't work because, these are two of the reasons that I like to say. So, geodesic equation does not give you Lorentz force, and moreover, equations of motion do not impose divergence of magnetic field. So in fact, the longitudinal magnetic component of this anti-symmetric tensor field, as you're going to see, is precisely what is the dynamical field in this case, unlike in the case of electromagnetism. And John proposed in 1979 a non-symmetric theory of gravitation, which is weight, which is basically generalizing the theory and simply saying that B is not electromagnetic field, but instead is some kind of gravitational field. And using a principle of covariance, then you can actually build a theory of gravity on it. And apart from Einstein-Hilbert term, there are other terms that are allowed by this. And nevertheless, theory doesn't seem to be working as well as one would hope for. Then there is other, there are of course motivations why I would like to do something like this. And you know that Einstein's theory worked extremely well. At least this is the standard law. However, there are certain disconcerting parts of Einstein's theory which you don't quite understand. And in particular, we don't understand what's going on scales of galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and also the whole universe. And therefore, one has invented dark matter and dark energy to somehow account for this. Alternatively, one can simply modify gravity on these very large scales, and that's the second way to go. And at the moment, it's not completely clear what is the right way. And this is just an example. I'm going to show you some of the nice plots that John produced a few years back, where he fitted to a certain version of the theory. Rotational curves of galaxies, galaxies being quite different sizes, and it has been shown that so basically what you can see here is that if you see rotational velocity as a function of radius, radius is typically can be 10 kiloparsec up to 100 kiloparsec for galaxies, and so these circles are observational points. The green lines are what would be the rotational curve without any dark matter. And that means in GR, non-modifying gravity, and the black curves are the ones which get modifying gravity. So as you see that one can actually reproduce pretty well those. Of course, the question was always what happens to clusters, and there's been recently quite a lot of excitement considering bullet cluster, and I guess John can tell you more about it. If you just proceed with the covariant extension of GR and include this non-symmetric tensor field, then there are problems, and the theory contains ghosts and instabilities. So this has been known already since the 90s. Nevertheless, you can actually reverse the problem and say, what is the more general theory that is problem-free? And of course, we don't know it, but you could take the following principle. You could simply say, let's assume that gravity is Einstein plus some small correction to it, and expand in the small correction, and assume that this small correction is of the type of antisymmetric tensor field. And when you expand the action to quadratic order, there are no linear terms. The term zeroth order, which is Hilbert-Einstein, and then the terms that are quadratic. And this turns out to be the most general quadratic extension of such a theory, where H here denotes the field strength associated. It has, of course, three indices, because B has two indices. So it's a fully antisymmetric extension. Fully antisymmetric, of course, the three-index field strength, and so this is kinetic term. And then there are terms, well, this also respects some kind of gauge invariance associated with the field. But since we are in theory of gravitation, there is no reason that gauge invariance really should be respected. So there are two other terms that are allowed, and one of them is coupling to something like a mass term, and the other one is coupling to Ricci scale. General extensions of gravity also generate these type of couplings. That means coupling of the B field to Riemann tensor and to Ricci tensor. And these ones generate, in general, these are the source of trouble. And you want to somehow cancel them or get rid of them. So this is sort of the general principle is the following. This is the action that I like. And the question is, you would like to ask, can I now start from that action and build on it and some kind of symmetry principle and try to construct something that is and that contains that action as the limit? So that's one approach that you could actually take. Yeah. Yes?
Actually, one can start from action that doesn't contain
You don't get what?
You don't get ghosts in the weak field
approximation. Okay, so I would like to see in that action actually. Yes, but this one contains no ghost. This one here. Yes?
What do you mean by this kind of thing from a geometric theory?
Well, basically it means that, well, this is what we have shown quite generally in that paper. You can add all kinds of terms to your effective action, and of course the obvious one is this one, and so this is the obvious term, but then there are other terms. You can actually you get the antisymmetric connection, which is also covariant, and you can then square it in a way that you just contract all the indices, and there are different ways of doing this. So you get coefficients here. And so if you write all possible terms that contain up to two derivatives in two time derivatives, so that means the most general quadratic action, then you will find that generically there will be this type of term appearing in this expansion with the non-zero coefficient. And you cannot get rid of it. So this is, roughly speaking, what happens. For the moment, what I'll do is I will actually assume that the linearized form is what you've seen on the form of transparency. And then I will try to understand, is there any way of, you know, what can that give us something interesting for cosmology? And this is, I'm not the first one who have done something similar. So something similar has already been done, and it is known as the Kalman-Ramon axiom. So this type of action appears, you know, you can also add a dilatant to it, but appears as a consequence of string complexifications. And you get something like this as an effective action. And it turns out that you can actually perform a duality transformation in such a way that you actually replace this action, but this one, where sigma is a pseudoscalar field, which is called Kalman-Ramon axiom. So in other words, this field strand here for this particular action represents the antisymmetric tensor field, the kinetic term of it, which only contains one physical degree of freedom, which is equivalently a pseudoscalar axiom. This axiom, of course, is just ordinary scalar field that fluctuates in the early universe. And it turns out if you add it a mass, you actually get a massive axiom, which is a dark matter candidate. So this has been studied in literature so far. Nevertheless, this massive axiom is actually not equivalent to massive B field. And if you actually try to do the transformation on this action for which B field is massive, you're going to get some non-local term here, which is not really a mass of sigma. So these two actions are inequivalent. So in that sense, what I'm going to tell you today has not been studied in the literature. So we really have to, we cannot do this duality transformation as soon as we have a mass term here. And without mass term also, this doesn't work. So in other words, if you don't have a mass term, this field fluctuates in the universe, but it does not give you enough fluctuations to be observable or significant. So you need a mass term. And so therefore, I will assume there is a mass term. And towards the end of the talk, I'll tell you what the mass term I need and how I might be able to get it. So I'm going to assume standard cosmology. So the universe goes through a period of inflation, radiation and matter era. And then such a universe, of course, in general, has metric tensor of this form. So it's conformal to Minkowski type of metric. And where A is the scale factor. So in general, it's a function of time. So it's different function of time, inflation, radiation, matter era. So this form is actually general for all cases. I will actually, for simplicity, set Ricci scalar to zero. And so now what we have to do is we have to solve this theory, A first in inflation, B in radiation, and C in matter era. And just for curiosity, you can see the kinetic term. It has a term 1 over a squared here. And so this 1 over a squared comes from the fact that there are many inverse metric factors here. So which gives me 1 over a squared, each of them. Well, the action for the scalar field has a squared. So what it means actually, for example, in inflation, which is rapidly expanding, the scale factor goes almost exponentially. This growth of the scale factor suppresses any kinetic term in the scalar field. On the other hand, here it happens quite the opposite. Here the scale factor appears as 1 over a squared, and the antisymmetric tensor field can fluctuate with arbitrary large amplitudes. Basically, this is what... of course, one has to be careful when one says such statements. Yes?
Can I So you said, okay, if it were mass does, then it would be some gauge symmetry, now you put a mass, but in some sense, now you could add tuple work, right? And then it was gauge symmetry, and then your theory would be probably a theory of a B field plus a vector, which is tuple work.
Yes.
So I'm just trying to decouple in your story, what's the, what part of your story in that language would be the B field that does shift under gauge symmetry and then the spookle work?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I expect the B field that does that would shift there under gauge transformation probably doesn't do much. That's my intuition.
Theory is it's like a magical perfect theory.
Exactly.
Yeah.
With the
That's right. So in that theory, you could have simple cool bird, if you get EMF plus a scalar, which is the Goldstone.
You can show that at intersection function, you can show that this theory is interesting.
Yeah.
Like magical perfect.
Yeah, precisely. So in fact, when you make that's a good observation. So in fact, there is a duality transformation that transforms this field into massive vector field. So it's a Proca theory. So this theory is called the Proca. Of course, you can ask, why should I bother calculating this? I can just calculate massive vector field. That's true, as long as you don't add any interactions. So as soon as I add an interaction, then this interaction upon duality transformation will become non-local. And it would be horrible to work in variables, in dual variables, with non-local interaction terms. So given the fact that I assume that this theory contains interactions, so I'm just decided to work in these variables. Okay. So, but equivalently, I could work in the massive gauge variables. So there is a, so in electric magnetic decomposition, you can actually see also from here that electric field corresponds to spin 1 particle minus component and magnetic to spin 1 particle plus component. And the equations of motion are derived by varying the action, and they look very much like Maxwell's equations in this decomposition. So it's very reminiscent of Maxwell's theory. Except that divergence of B is missing, so there is no divergence of B equation here, as a consequence, the longitudinal component of B may be dynamical. In fact, it is, but other equations are actually what would you expect from Maxwell's theory. Another thing. So you see that E and B are not independent. They're related by this equation. So once you know E, you know B, basically. So it makes sense. The number of degrees of freedom really is 1 in the massless case or 3 in the massive case because they're not independent. So because of this constraint equation, right? And that's basically it. Now, what we want to now do is we want to solve it in cosmology. That means you have rapidly expanding inflationary space where the mode starts on very small scales and they extend on subhalbal. And then they go through radiation matter era and become subhalbal again in late times. So, so this is for each commoving mode. And so the in general, so we have a linear theory. So we can do linear decomposition, and these are creational relational modes in them, which have standard commutation relation. And this is polarization tensor, which is again orthogonal. So this is just for the longitudinal mode, and I can do the same thing for the transverse mode. And the equation of motion looks like that. So this equation of motion is similar at the first sight, but it's also different than any one you have seen so far, because it contains the factors, scale factors, and the derivatives in different ways than you're used to. In fact, I put the scale factor here in front. If I had a scalar field, I would have put 1 over A, but here I put A in order to get rid of B prime term, so here. So I don't have a friction anymore. So I chose this scaling in such a way. And so this is the equation now I need to solve for the mode functions, both in inflation, radiation, matter error, and then do the appropriate matching. So, and that's what we have done. So first of all, inflation is approximated by the Sutter space, and in the Sutter, so I'm in conformal time. In the Sutter, the scale factor is minus 1 over eta. Eta is negative, and it turns out that this combination of the derivatives of scale factors comes out to be zero. So what it means is surprisingly that, you know, apart from the mass term, the field is actually conformal in the Sutter inflation. So I'm going to make this approximation here. So I'm going to solve it in the Sutter inflation, and the corrections are small in the sense that they're proportional to slow roll parameter. And the only term that breaks conformal invariance is the mass term, and that generates something. And the solutions are just Hankel functions. So Hankel functions actually, unlike in the case of scalar field, you can actually expand these Hankel functions around mass equal to zero if mass is much smaller than h. In the case of scalar, this expansion will be singular. But here, actually, you can actually do it. So the mode functions are actually, to good approximation, just plane waves up to order m over h corrections. So this is something that we actually use in order to do the matching and study the case, this type of expansion. In radiation error, however, this combination of derivative scale factor is non-zero anymore. So what actually happens is that the true mode functions look like Bunch-Davis vacuum for the scalar in radiation error. So conformal symmetry is actually broken in radiation and matter error, even in the massless limit. And, of course, the mode functions are a linear combination of the two plane waves and with this condition for the scalar. This is like the same condition in the scalar case. And you can calculate the matching conditions in the massless case. We have also done, you can also do study what actually happens when you include mass corrections, which I will not, you know, it's complicated, so I will not present it here. Because in the case when you include the mass corrections, then you have to match Hankel functions onto Weitekamp functions, which is not easy. But it can be done. And then in order to avoid any confusion, you would like to calculate some physical quantity. And of course, the physical quantity is stress energy tensor. So this is the 0-0 component of it. And of course, you have just what you would expect, the standard contribution that looks this way, which also is there in the mass equal to zero limit. But then you also have contribution coming from the mass term. And this is the energy density of this anti-symmetric tensor field. And then I will then define like the spectrum of this field. I call it PNGT. This is the standard definition of what you would normally define as a spectrum. So it's it's expectation value, dk over k, and then the spectrum. So you have to multiply T00 in momentum space by k cubed to get the spectrum. And then this is what the spectrum looks like. So we can then calculate it and plot it and see what actually happens. And in the massless case, you get spectrum like this. So in radiation era. So what actually happens is, and it also scales 1 over 8 to the fourth. So it's like massless. It's like radiation, right? So basically what you actually get is k-squared part on super-Hubble scales, and then something that is flat on oscillatory on sub-Hubble scales. And in fact, you would get the same thing if you calculate mass scalar, because the stress energy of or energy density of mass is zero, and the reason is because of this duality. You know, the Kalber-Mohn axiom will generate exactly the same spectrum. for the energy density. But of course, we are interested in the mass corrections. And this is just to compare, for example, what you get from gravitons. You know, there is some phase shift on sub-Hubble scales, and then in gravitons, yeah?
So this could then be fought on electromagnetic field, could it?
Yes.
It can be.
Yes. No. No. I mean, it could be in the massive case, but this is massless. So it's really like a scalar.
In the massless case, it cannot be the electromagnetic field. Why not?
No, because it's not dual to photon. It's dual to scalar. Photon is does not have a longitudinal degree of freedom. It only has transverse ones,
yeah.
And these are and photon degrees of freedom are conformal in all cosmological spaces. So it has completely different spectrum. It doesn't break. It just has a standard backing
spectrum. You're saying that the limit of mass going to zero is not
scalar. Yes. It's a singular limit, in fact. And this is just perhaps not a good comparison, but I've compared the graviton spectrum with this spectrum. The graviton has a flat spectrum on super-Hubble scales, but this one has k-squared spectrum. And there is a similar sub-Hubble spectrum, but there is a shift in phase. What's important now, this is important, what are the corrections coming from Mars? And so here you can actually see how things evolve in time. So this is function of time in radiation era, and this is a spectrum. And you sort of here see that what you've just seen on two transparencies before, k square and then flat with oscillatory component in the massless limit. When you add the mass, then you see there is an enhancement. And bigger the mass, the enhancement is bigger. There is also a certain suppression on super Hubble scales, but enhancement wins over suppression. So that means that energy density grows more as soon as you start adding mass. And that is the crucial observation. So now I'm going to plot it now if you increase even further, you see the same effect. But here is a snapshot.
So what happens to the wind density of the cargo container that increased? Because the mode was also increasing rapidly with the scale factor.
Yeah, the energy density is like, yes, it's k squared and then I think flat. Or so. No, or is it k to the fourth, perhaps? I'm not sure. But it's very suppressed on super Hubble scales. So, in other words, if you say, you know, if you plot sigma sigma, you will get a flat spectrum. But sigma sigma, from the point of view of this field, is not an observable. It's you know, the gradient of sigma is B. So if you invert that, that's a non-local inversion. So any correlator of B field is non-local related to correlators of sigma. So it's in this way, it's actually incorrect to say that there is a flat spectrum coming from inflation because the relation is non-local. And but some people like to say that way, and I don't. Now, this is a snapshot. This is really telling you what's really going on. And again, this black curve is k squared and then oscillatory flat for very, very small mass. And now this red curve is increasing mass, and the blue curve is when the mass is bigger. And what you see here is that there is a characteristic bump that is developing. And this bump is, first of all, on sub-Hubble scales. And second, the amplitude of this bump is much bigger than if there is no mass. So there is an enhancement in power. Yes.
So what happens when you put in matter?
But we have not. Yes.
If you put in matter.
Yes. That's a good question. Yeah. Yes. Well. Sure. But I will try to answer this question in a couple of minutes. Okay. Now, what happens in matter era? In matter era, I can solve things in the massless limit, And again, this is the energy density now as a function of time. This is at the radiation matter equality, basically. Again, you see something from radiation. But then again, even in the massless case, scalar field or antisymmetric tensor field develop this characteristic bump. This bump will probably also be seen in the gravitons, stress energy tensor of some kind. Of course, the question is what actually happens with this type of bump when I include the mass term? And what happens is the following. If I increase mass, I suppress the spectrum naively. This is now as a function of time. But it starts growing, actually. So it's not flat anymore. So it will start further growing. And perhaps I can. So now there are three different cases. So this is the light field. And this is intermediate. And this is heavy. And what you see in the case of light field, you recognize that the bump starts shifting, but the shift is towards smaller scales, but the shift is actually rather small. Now, as I increase the mass, the shift increases, and so here is actually outside the scale. So first of all, the bump increases in size, and it shifts towards smaller scales. Again, also in matter era, there is more power on very small scales. There is another interesting feature, which is that if you actually calculate the associated pressure, you will also find some kind of oscillations.
What the masses?
Yeah, that's a good question. The thing is, actually, this is not a very good way of writing this mass. So. That's the eta equality, yeah. And this is, but there is a, perhaps after my talk, I can actually give you a better way of writing this. So it's some kind of geometric mean between H equality and mass, I think, divided by H at the end of inflation, something like that. Anyway, there is no, I don't quite remember, but there is a better way of writing this. One other thing is that there are these peculiar pressure oscillations which also can source gravitational potentials. So these are like Bardeen or Newtonian potentials. But the thing is that these oscillations will be probably on scale, well, actually in this model they are on scales that are too small to be observable by, let's say, galaxy survey or CMB. So we were thinking for a little while that this could be like a smoking gun for this theory, but unfortunately these oscillations are too small. So let me just summarize the first part of my talk. So the question is, what is the mass that you actually need? And that's the number. So it's 0.03 electron volt if H is 10 to the 13 GeV. So 10 to the 13 is the typical granular scale H, right? And then if H decreases, then the mass quite dramatically increases because you need more mass to get the equal amount of power. So the question is, of course, that's the mass we need. And this is perhaps a window how to test this theory. Since we cannot observe this directly, you would like to formulate some mechanism for mass generation, and then through which you couple this theory, for example, to particle physics or to gravity, and then based on this, you could make some predictions. But of course, that's all would be then model dependent. So this is actually this is certainly a generic statement that one can make. So then, without interactions, as I said, this theory is equivalent to massive axiom and not to massive vector. Well, it's not equivalent to massive axiom, but instead to massive vector field. And of course, if this field is gravitational, then you would also expect that at the scale, which is given by the inverse mass scale, which is about 0.1 micrometers, you might also expect some corrections to gravitational force on those scales. And finally, you have seen that all of these plots that, so this is a very, very cold field. It's very non-thermal, just like axion. But it has a power that is peaked, a certain characteristic momentum. So that momentum is, so here I've written it in a better way. So this momentum is actually a geometric mean between the mass and Hubble radius today, up to some small correction coming from the equal matter radiation error. Yeah, so that's basically the scale at which it peaks, and if you actually calculate it, you get roughly Earth sun distance. Yes.
Here, this is a different approach.
Yes.
So as you're saying, you don't actually keep, you're adding
field
decreased freedom.
Yeah.
It's not pure Einstein.
Yes.
And I have this vector plot.
Yeah.
So actually, when you look at the Newton's equations, you're going to change.
Sure.
The Newtonian acceleration.
Yeah.
So you're really modifying gravity.
Yes, yeah.
Two ways of looking at this.
Yeah.
The graviton has never been detected.
Yeah.
It's like a gravitonic particle.
Yeah.
And you probably won't ever detect the graviton.
Yeah.
So it's not strictly speaking the standard dark matter.
Yeah, sure, sure. No, I agree. So, but this is what I can say at the level of linearized theory. Now, what you're telling me, oh, but when you include interactions, this story becomes more complex. I completely agree. Yeah, exactly. That's certainly true. Yeah. And even at this level, actually, even at this level, it does couple to gravity. And it couples to gravity through those terms. So I've calculated rho and p, and this in standard gravity, gr. But the potential is being sourced through these equations. So I will now show you.
I have a question. So maybe that scale is too small, but for CMB, do you get any?
It's too small. It's too small. I mean, this the mass the mass in these lumps is it's sub Earth mass. I mean, it's like a big mountain. I mean, it's not very big. So, and I even estimated what's the time scale by which they would agglomerate, and I got analytically rough estimate that it's the age of the universe. So, I mean, it's.
But this is very similar to ordinary CDF, supersymmetric wind. They have structure,
understand. Yeah, but it's a thermal wind. So yes, I mean there, you know, you can treat almost, well, this is classical field theory.
Yeah.
But you can treat these like almost like particles whose mass is given by the mass on that scale. Well, because that's where the power is concentrated.
Yes, but the particles are really much less massive. We have a lot of particles at the
end. That's true. Yeah. But the spectrum is very, very non-thermal. So the power is concentrated on certain scales. I mean, you cannot resolve scales that are smaller than that particular scale.
Okay. Do you get a scale invariant power spectrum?
No.
So then what?
No, it's very non-invariant.
So then you need.
That's the spectrum.
You have an inflaton that gives you a scale invariant power spectrum.
Exactly. So what you see here is that the spectrum is k squared on very large scales. It remains so. If you add a mass, it doesn't change. You can only scale it up or down a bit. But adding a mass doesn't change anything.
So it's scaling a very small k.
Not even that. Because you see, there is a bump. There is a bump. I mean, there is a bump, and then it's for very, very small k. Yes, yes. Yes, yes. Yeah. But this bump is on, you know, on Earth-Sun distance, so it's very, very small scale. So you need many of those, and then many of those start interacting, and then they start falling in, they start forming, you know, random wells, and these are random wells of dark matter. So, and on very large scales, you know, on cosmologically observable scales, so I'm here in the tail, so the power here is much, much too weak to be of any impact on CMB. And so, so now the question is, of course, can we embed this theory into some dynamical theory such which actually contains antisymmetric tensor field? And I will show you an attempt to do that, and I will also then discuss in the end what are the difficulties with this approach. So and the idea is to actually formulate gravity on phase space in a way. So so I guess here on this transparency is pretty much everything. So this is the work of Christian Mons, who is my master's student. So this is his master's thesis, and he's actually looking for PhD positions. So it's, you should keep this in mind. So the idea here is to extend space-time, which is x nu, right? It's four-dimensional space-time, to add something imaginary part to it, and combine it into complex quantity. Now, of course, and then defined, instead of working on Riemannian manifold, we actually work on complex manifold, which actually contains x, it's defined by z, which means it's 4 plus 4 eight-dimensional space-time, really. So now the proposal here is that Einstein gravity is actually defined on eight-dimensional space-time. And of course, that sounds like a disaster, because you would have, in Einstein's gravity, you have a certain number of degrees of freedom in each point in space-time, right? So here I'm adding a tower. In each point, I'm erecting another four dimensions, and so I would be able to put infinitely many more particles there. So I would have infinitely many more degrees of freedom in the theory, unless I impose some very powerful symmetry that reduces my degrees of freedom precisely to the number I need. And that symmetry, or one possibility, is holomorphy, right? So you basically say in my field bound or tetrahedron, right? It's a function of z, but it's not a function of z bar. So it's not a function of the complex conjugate. And this way, the field bound is effectively a four-dimensional function. So I've defined all dynamics on, actually, with the functions that are effectively four-dimensional this way. Yes, it is actually not that different. The difference is actually that I'm retaining as much as possible from GR here. And of course, the question is what is the interpretation of these extra four dimensions? And I think this is also, this probably differs from Twistor's. So the interpretation is I want to somehow relate it to energy momentum. And this is some kind of a phase space formulation of GR. So if this is energy momentum, then there is a unique combination of fundamental constants which will make this length scale. And this is G over C cubed time energy momentum. So G over C cubed, right? And then this has dimension of meter. And there is, just observe, there is no H bar here anyway. So we are still in classical theory. Of course, since these are fundamental constants, I like to put just those two. But in principle, you could have a dimensionless parameter, which is something like a coupling constant, which I didn't put. But it's something that naturally you would expect to be order one. So just to avoid any complications, I'm just going to set this parameter to one. And so far, otherwise, there is this uniqueness apart from that. And the question is, what is this energy momentum? And the way I like to think about it is the following way. Just think of space-time, and then you have various observers, and they are all moving at various velocity with respect to space-time, and various different momentum and different energy. They have different energy with respect to this background space-time. So all of these observers will have actually will see different physics, depending on how they move with respect to the, some kind of underlying space-time. So in other words, I'm breaking general covariance this way. So I call this P nu for energy momentum of moving frames. And of course, what you want is you want line elements to be Hermitian, right? So to be real. So then it's actually convenient to form metric tensor in terms of this as product of two tetrads, so you can actually metric tensor form as et times e or e dagger times e, where e is the tetrad here, and then the line element is simply given by this simple form dz c dz. And you're going to see in a little bit later in detail how it works. In principle, the most general, this is, so what we've done is actually we have actually formulated it in an eight-dimensional setting. So we have, just to make facilitate calculations, we have actually written it as an eight-dimensional metric tensor in which you have a, perhaps I should actually write it here. If I write something like C mu nu, what I mean is, I mean E of Z, mu E of Z, and nu, and then I have A, B, and I have eta A, B. So then this one is this, this is how it's defined, and if I have one index barred, then what I mean is E mu Z, E nu bar of Z bar eta AB. So you see this is the complex conjugate tetrad whenever I have a bar index here. And of course there are four possible combinations, and then you can form two by two matrix this way. And this is the more general case where you can actually have all the elements non-vanishing, and then you can restrict yourself to by symmetry to have either this one or that one. And what I'll consider today is this and that case, and I will not. This is just a basic linear combination of the two. And I will construct the theory based on this line element and based on that line element. So this is basically the metric tensor is a combination of tetrad and its Hermitian conjugate, and here is the metric tensor is combination of tetrad, two tetrads. So this is the holomorphic case. And this is the Hermitian case. And as you're going to see here, well, what's important, the reason why I wrote it this way is because this metric tensor now eight-dimensional is actually symmetric. So since this is symmetric, we can actually treat this gravity theory as a symmetric theory in this eight-dimensional sense. Even though it does contain, from here it's clear that there are 16 elements here, when I, in general, there can be 16 distinct elements. So in other words, when I form, when I start with this tetrad, I can actually form metric tensor that contains 10 symmetric degrees of freedom plus 6 anti-symmetric, it turns out. So at least this is the case in this theory. But this is just the introduction, and I'm going to now say a few more definite words about the Hermitian case. And this is sort of inspired by an old paper by Max Born, in which he said he loves something like he calls reciprocity symmetry, and he would like that nature-based symmetry. And the symmetry would be the symmetry on the exchange of x and p, p being momentum, and p goes to minus x. And naively, if you look at Hamilton's equations, they seem to obey that symmetry, provided the Hamiltonian obeys it as well. But in general, a Hamiltonian, let's say even a harmonic oscillator, will not obey that symmetry. So Hamilton equations under this transformation transform into... No, it still retains the same form, but the... But you would have to, you have to define the mass of the oscillator in the right way to actually respect, and that's a very special choice. And so, but in general, Hamiltonian goes to the reciprocal Hamiltonian under that transformation. Nevertheless, there are things that that respect that symmetry, which is angular momentum. So an angular momentum, of course, has something to do with torsion of space-time. So if angular momentum is preserved, then you can also say that the torsion is also unchanged. So imposing this symmetry has some close relation to torsion of space-time. Also, what's a nice thing is the commutation relation obeys that symmetry as well. So in principle, we can quantize the theory without violating that symmetry if the classical one also contains it. So that's a good thing about it. So the hope is that quantizing such a theory will lead to something nice. Now, mathematically, Hermitian gravity is defined on Hermitian space, where metric tensor is invariant under an almost complex structure J, which is a tensor which maps a tangent space into tangent space, and in such a way that, again, this reciprocal symmetry is obeyed. So, and then Hermitian space is defined as a space on which metric tensor is invariant under that transformation. So, in a way, what you can say is the Hermitian spaces are a realization of this Max Born idea of reciprocity symmetry, if you can formulate gravity on it. But, of course, we can formulate in terms of x and y, but it's more convenient to formulate it in terms of complex variables. And, indeed, such a formulation exists, and, again, in the eight-dimensional form, this is how it looks. Exactly.
And B0 will correspond to the Hamiltonian.
To the energy.
Yeah.
Not Hamiltonian, energy.
To the energy to the Hamiltonian values. But similarly for...
But energy of what? It's not a particle. It's the frame. I mean, it's sort of... you can think of it as an observer-dependent statement.
And similarly, your x1, x2, x3 will be like... In that part of your case, will be like scale factors. And your p1, p2, p3 will be... A dots.
No, they are not A dots.
Or A dot A.
They are not A dots. That's important.
So what are they?
They are extra coordinates that live on that space, that characterize the space.
But aren't these like the momentas of...
No. No. Okay. So
what do you mean this symmetry is imposed, like, what is imposed, like, what is the formula understanding symmetry between time and energy, like, what is the meaning of this symmetry?
Well, Max Born likes to think of it as a symmetry between small world and big world, and it's also similar to this T-duality of string theory. So, I mean, it has a little bit of relevance to it, but it's basically saying that, you know, large energy means small scale in some sense, in the Fourier sense. So if you map time into energy, and time is big, then energy is big. So it's like it relates the GR world is the big world, but the you know big scales, big times, etc., and small energies. Right? And if you do this mapping, you actually go to the small world, which is Transplanckian world, basically, in which energy dominates, let's say. And I'm running out of time, but I want to say a little bit later more about the interpretation of it when I come to concrete cases, right? So this is Z. Z is just X plus IY, so it makes sense to actually rotate to X and Y basis here. And if I do this rotation, I can rewrite this matrix element, this line element, in terms of x, y, and there is b contribution as well. So b mixes x and y, contribution to line element. So when you measure distances in this theory, you're going to see that distances are also affected by the anti-symmetric tensor field, but only if there is a non-zero energy associated with the frame. So if you're in the frame which contains non-zero energy moment. And well, I hope that this will actually make things clearer. So so upon this rotation to the x and y basis, these different elements of this, now my eight-dimensional tensor becomes non-diagonal, and the off-diagonal part is anti-symmetric tensor field in this case. And it's related to the original elements of the matrix in the following way. So so let us consider flat space limit in this case. And something very peculiar happens. Apart, of course, the distances, even this flat space limit, the distances apart from the standard contribution, you also have contribution coming from energy momentum of the moving frame. However, the constant coming in front is tiny. It's 10 to the minus 72 seconds squared kilometer minus 2. So you need to have a huge contribution coming from here, which is essentially force, full force, in order for this to be any significant. Nevertheless, it's there. And the question is, what is its significance? Of course, if you drop that term, you just get the standard light cone. So you get the standard light cone structure without that term. Or if you are sort of on shell, if your frame is such that this combination is zero. Now, and so you get a speed that is smaller than the speed of light. Now, if this term is non-zero, then causality structure changes, and then you have two particular cases. When p squared is actually negative, then the light cone opens up, and there are two hyperbolas that appear here. And what actually happens here is anything between zero and r is in causal contact at any time. So there is a violation of causality here. So up to this distance r max, and if you look at what this distance is, it's a square root of minus p squared, but then it's suppressed by g over c cubed. So you need to have a very large p squares before, so to be able to observe this violation of causality. In the opposite case, when p squared is positive, and that means when momentum part dominates of the frame, then actually the causal structure reverses, and you actually need some minimum time to be able to establish any causal contact. So you have hyperbolas this way. This is the surface of simultaneity, t equals zero. So that's basically what the theory looks like. Now, you can also look at phase velocity, and phase velocity does something funny, so it becomes imaginary at sufficiently short periods of time. So that means that there are things that decay rather than propagate. But the group velocity, of course, you don't want group velocity to be imaginary. So you want to restrict yourself to real group velocities, because you only can relate events that actually can propagate between each other. So group velocity must be real. And that gives you a restriction on the full force. That gives you an upper bound on the full force. So there is a maximum. In other words, if you exceed, you can exceed that full force. But if you exceed it, you will find out that nothing can propagate anymore. So there is this upper bound on full velocity of the moving frame that you can actually have. But the group velocity can exceed the speed of light if f squared is negative, and that's indeed what happens here. And let me just go very quickly through this. So we have now looked at the geodesic equations, and we propose the geodesic equation must be obtained by varying the line element rather than any other way. And if you do it, And you look at the standard literature, which is there is a book on complex spaces, Hermitian complex spaces, basically, by Natahara, and they have a different definition of connection. Their definition of connection says that it must be metric compatible or tetrad compatible. That's how they derive it. But if you vary the action, you get something else. And we prefer those metric connections, in fact. And the geodesic equation looks this way in the complex form. You can then write it easily. Geodesic equation you can easily then write in this rotated frame, XY frame. Oh, what is that? I jumped over something. Now, there is a... There is something that's missing here. Oh. Right. I was here. Now, what about dynamics? Well, it turns out that's basically a killer. If you vary the Hilbert-Einstein action, and you will get this type of equation, where this is just the Einstein tensor. These equations are non-dynamical. Sorry? Then this is Hermitian case. This is the Hermitian case.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are getting non-dynamical theory, and I'm pretty sure that's correct. So we don't get second time derivatives. So in other words, we only get constraints, and this actually agrees with our counting of degrees of freedom. So there are no. It doesn't matter. I mean, we have some general coordinate transformation which looks this way. So the first index is holomorphically transformed, the second is anti-holomorphically transformed. And when you now expand this to second order in some small parameter, you'll get curvature invariants. And this curvature invariants, you count degrees of freedom, you realize that you can actually remove them all by choosing your coordinate transformation the right way. Which means that this theory actually doesn't have dynamical degrees of freedom at all. And that was a great disappointment for us. And I still have a hope that perhaps I can solve it. I can actually save it, but I'm not sure this can work. And this is what I'm currently looking at. The possible way of saving it could be that when I project onto four-dimensional space, that also, you know, this theory flows across four-dimensional space into this orthogonal directions, right? And if you take all the information on that part into account, these derivatives, and then solve for those, and again, you might get an effective four-dimensional theory that contains dynamics. So dynamics might be sort of induced by projecting in the right way on the four-dimensional space, but it's far from being proven. Anyway, this theory is in trouble. However, holomorphic version, if you remember, holomorphic version is obtained by holomorphic metric tensor, so it's just the product of two holomorphic tetrads, and that one it turns out to work quite well. So I will just give you the main results. So again, causality structure is changed in a similar way. The flat space limit again, you have some changes in phase and group velocity, but the dynamics in this case works fine. And now I just have two transparencies before I'm finished. So, and I think it's important enough to discuss this. So the cosmology is discussed in such, well, it's solved in such a way to make the holomorphic ansatz for the tetrad. And we have derived the Friedmann equations after some effort. So we managed to reduce them to the standard form. And when you solve it for the Hubble parameter, you get something like this. Now you see you have energy, you have time. And of course, the Hubble parameter is the real part of that quantity, which has this form. And if I plot it, so this is Hubble parameter as a function of time. So this is GR, and this is holomorphic gravity. So you see the real part of this function actually goes to zero as time goes to zero, as long as E is non-zero. Of course, you can ask the question, well, why should E be non-zero? And these are expanding space-time, so energy is non-conserved. So The way to understand that is the following way. I mean, it's like expanding universe is like you know, particles climbing out of some potential well, so they lose energy, so energy is not conserved. Alternatively, I can think of myself as an observer, which is freely falling backward in time. And if I do that, I will gain energy, E. In other words, space-time will appear to me as a space-time with more and more energy in it. So, and after singularity, E is going to grow. So, and that's the consequence of solution of geodesic equation for a free-falling observer. So in other words, it's natural, from my point of view, an observer which has a zero or positive energy, E, I will never be able to see singularity if I just look backward in time. So I think it's reasonable to say that for most of observers that we can relate to, that this space-time is free of singularity. And similarly, something similar happens in the case of black holes. So we can solve, again, Z is, we can solve for Schwarzschild's solution. So it looks exactly the same because of the symmetry. And Z now contains real and imaginary parts. And when you now, of course, the line element is real, so you have to add Hermitian conjugate to this to get the line element. But there is a prescription, right? So I've just given you the time part and the radial part of the line element, and I suppressed energy momentum parts for simplicity. And what you actually see here is that provided P is non-zero, again, there is no singularity at R equals zero. So in other words, if I take some curvature invariant squared, so it's a scalar. So as you know, it's proportional to 1 by r to the sixth. But in our theory, it's a real part of this quantity. At r equal to 0, this is black hole singularity. This reduces to this form, which is actually not singular, provided that p is non-zero. And again, you can solve, if you now look at the freely falling observer that falls to the black hole, you can actually show that p grows. So p grows, and you can actually calculate what p would be for an observer that starts with p equals 0. So in other words, if I'm falling in the black hole, my corresponding p of freely falling observer with respect to the frame actually grows. And that's the mechanism how singularity is removed in this theory. So this holomorphic gravity has all these nice features, it turns out. But when you look at the degrees of freedom, it has a metric tensor, and it has another tensor which is symmetric. So it doesn't have torsion. So in that sense, it's perhaps not what I initially wanted. But unfortunately, there's a Hermitian gravity which has precisely 10 plus 6 degrees of freedom that you want, and it contains torsion. It has this problem with that it's non-dynamical. So, but holomorphic gravity seems to work perfectly. We have not studied what is the role of the second metric tensor field in the holomorphic gravity. So in this analysis, I've assumed that it's actually not really excited. And anyway, this is a summary of my talk, and I thank you for your attention.
So if you have one particle that's moving with some momentum
into
space, it follows some trajectory based on this
metric.
And if you have just a second particle next to it moving with the same momentum, now, would you consider the two of them together having twice as much momentum, or would you consider them separately?
Yes, but the momentum, you know, the momentum of those particles is given by x dot, right? This is...
mass times x dot, sorry.
Yeah, okay. And the other one is mass m1 and...
Yeah.
Right. And of course, but I, you know, there is only one p mu. And if I am now another observer, I will have a p mu prime. And of course, these will transform both of them in such a way, by the transformation.
Okay. I'm not transferring. I'm just saying, consider these two particles. could you consider them as one particle? Like if you don't have a good enough microscope, if you would see them as one particle.
I mean, the answer is exactly the same as GR. I don't understand the question.
But it's not the same as GR because your metric depends on momentum. So if you double the momentum of a particle, the metric I didn't see is different. So in GR, it only depends on the coordinates of two particles that are at the same point or close to each other, are moving in the same metric. They see the same metric. But then now, if I double the mass, the particle sees a different metric. So then I have this, I guess this looks like a contradiction of some or a paradox, I guess. Because
it's just breakdown of covariance, that's all. Why do you say it's a paradox?
No, I'm just saying so you could consider this in two different ways, as two different particles.
Yes.
You can solve the equation as one particle with the mass m1 plus m2. And you find you get two different solutions for a geodesic equation, right? Because you agree that you get two different solutions for a geodesic equation in these two cases.
Well, you're talking about they have the same P or not?
They have the same P, yes. That's the easiest case. They have the same, same P, everything is the same.
Yes. Well, if they can have different mass. I don't care about mass.
Yeah,
but let's say they have the same P.
Yeah.
Sure, then I can treat them as one particle.
Okay. But then, so you get different solutions if you treat them as one particle or don't treat them as one particle. You agree that you get this? Because moment P enters in your metric. So if you double the momentum, you get the particle sees a different metric. So
I see what you're saying. Yeah. So in one case you get one momentum, and the other case you get P1 plus P2, right? Which is equal to P. And true, but I mean I don't see that this is inconsistent with anything.
Well, so if these four particles were independent, they didn't know about each other, then you would solve the geodesic equation independently for P1 and P2. But if you think they are the same, if you consider them as one particle, then you should solve the geodesic equation for P1 plus P2.
But geodesic is the only particle?
No, it's independent for every particle. So you get different solutions. If your metric depends on momentum, you get different solutions. So that's what. Yeah.
No, I agree. But no, I completely agree with what you say. But I don't agree with the last statement, the conclusion.
Okay. So.
Yeah. We'll discuss it. Okay.
So in the case of the Hermitian gravity.
Yeah.
Was you also didn't have the connection which was compatible with the metric?
Yes, that's true. It's true. Our connection was incompatible with the metric.
So maybe isn't that the reason that you get a non-dimensional theory?
No. Okay. You also get it in the metric-compatible case. We checked it recently.
Because I thought maybe it's similar to the Pelicini case, but it's not.
Yeah. Yes?
Einstein-Strauss, 1945. Einstein's nth attempt at unifying field theory. He published a paper on this on symmetric results in 1925. He didn't say anything until 1926. He never referred to the 1925 paper. I think he forgot. Anyway, he had a Hermitian metric in a real four dimensions.
Yes, in real. I'm aware of it.
Dynamical theories from Einstein's
stuff. Yes, yes.
That's not, I understand, it's not what you're doing.
No, it's not. Yes. And this is why I was saying if I project now this theory, I might recover dynamics as a consequence of projection.
Maybe.
And the reason is because the dynamics is such that there is always a flow across four dimensions into the orthogonal directions. So if I also take into account of that flow, this flow contains some derivatives, right? So there is one derivative on this, and there is one derivative orthogonal flow. So if I take that into account, then I might recover second derivative.
Following the five dimensional theories, you're cursed with the fact so many, there's an infinite number of ways of projecting that. And this is the problem with string theory.
Why? But I mean, there is, I don't have to do anything. I don't know, but look, I just solved for you for cosmology. And look, this is the solution. So I have not done anything here. I've just solved the full equation. And that's the solution. That's true. That's true. This is the holomorphic Hubble parameter, right? And it lives on this eight-dimensional space. This is the real part of it. So that one lives on four dimensions, but I mean it doesn't live on four dimensions. It also has E in it.
This is a four
dimension. Well, I mean, it does not look. H does not depend on P. Because of the symmetry, homogeneity symmetry. And it does not depend on x. So it only depends on t and e. So it's a dimensional solution that is, I mean, there are only, the quantities vary only along four dimensions. And in fact, this variation is now reduced because of the symmetry to just one dimension here. And this is the symmetry holomorphy. So there is, of course, you can say there are two dimensions, but they appear in a very special combination, such that the function is, it's holomorphic, right?
Okay, it's getting late, so.
Yeah. Yeah, so.
Yeah, I'm just saying that we have two parts of the problem that are moving together.
Yeah.
Same momentum and moving the same.